And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, my little cemetery creepers, my little tombstone peepers. I'm here at Morningside Cemetery. My buddy and I were going to go on a glamorous vacation to a nice high-gravity world, but it appears he got here before me. And by the mess on the floor, I can tell he had a ball. Oh well, time to roll out the barrel, because sometimes your friends come up short.
Hello and welcome to a very special Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, one that I've been anticipating for many a year. I am Chris Honeywell. And this month we are doing one of my favorite films of all time, Phantasm. And when I say we are doing this film, I mean me and the whole crew is here. We've got Mr. Sean Engel.
Oh, my balls. I mean the giant silver foot.
I've got Luke Giaconetti.
If silver balls persist for more than 4 hours, contact your physician or wait till it stabs you in the head and shoots blood out of it.
Silver balls. This would have been a good Christmas show. And last but not least, Chris Tyler, the hair metal hero.
Hold on a second. A car just drove by my house. There was nobody driving!
Oh, get my shotgun. I'm going to shoot the engine. You know what the thing is? There was clearly someone driving.
Yeah. I was expecting him. There's nobody driving that car. No, dude, there was. Totally. Look, see?
It's
you see
dog.
Him? You see him?
He's right there.
There
he is. He may be ducked down, but no, yeah, he's there.
Yeah, see his knuckles?
I think
there
they were
is.
In England before that, so they were just used to looking on the left side of the car.
No, it's like the state flag of Florida, you know? It's just a pair of knuckles on the steering wheel and a hat. You know, it's the old dude. The blinker's still on from when he pulled out of the driveway that morning. It's a telltale sign. Seen it a million times.
Oh, Jesus. All right, man. Well, I'm going to get serious here because I just love this movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to say, what a great transition from the Italian movies to this, because I never realized it till I watched it this time. But this is an Italian... This would have gone really well with our Italian film festival that we just had.
Oh, yeah.
No. I was going to say, Coscarelli, that, you know...
His name is slightly Italian-sounding, I think.
So it wouldn't surprise me if he...
He's worked with Dino De Laurentiis extensively during his career, so
there you go. I know he... I don't know whether Dino De Laurentiis had anything to do with Beastmaster, which was another Coscarelli film. So that might be it.
Yeah, Coscarelli is actually... He was born in Libya, but grew up in... The Libyans, but grew up in California. But yeah, if you'd seen this movie as a directed by Donnie Coscarelli, it's like, yes. Oh, it must be an Italian movie.
Mm-hmm. Kind of sounded like Coscarelli there, Luke.
Well, the music, the logic of it.
logic?
Just
the way it's shot in
the
general.
The 70s-ness of it, the way it's shot, the dreaminess of it. Everything is just very in line with a lot of the stuff that we were watching in the other movies, and the gore, sudden, violent, horrifying gore.
In a way, it does seem very reminiscent to The Beyond and that sort of dreamlike feel that you get in the movie, that there's always this sort of surreal feel of it not being set in reality. That
right.
Whenever you go into the mausoleum or whatever, it always has this very uniquely unearthly feel. And that's how I can see how you would relate this to an Italian horror film.
In addition to The Beyond, the one that always made the connection in my mind was Suspiria. You know, in Suspiria, what is Suspiria about? It's about fantastical and bizarre things going on, and a young person's the only one who knows about it. Mm-hmm. And that's what Phantasm is about. And it's the same kind of idea of, you know, what goes on behind the closed doors in this, you know, very creepy, eerie place. You know, Coscarelli said that he got the idea to do it while thinking about the way that death is treated in the West, especially in the United States. You know, we had the idea of the mortician that does all this strange work behind closed doors that we're not familiar with, and then we have this big ritualistic funeral with at a ceremony in a church, and there's banners and people speak and all this stuff, because there's a lot of stuff to mine for a horror film there. Yeah, and you know, so like I said, I totally agree. I mean, it had been a long time since I had watched Phantasm, and I had forgotten kind of just how outlandish in a lot of ways, and not in a bad way, that this film is. The way that it treats the subject, and the way that the way that it's shot, the way it's lit, all of that. It really has been. You couldn't have picked this better if you had tried, Chris. And I know you didn't try, because trying is not your thing. I understand that, but you did a good job by accident lining this up. This was fantastic.
Yeah, because I didn't even think about that aspect of it until, like I said, just this latest rewatch of it. But I mean, I've seen this movie dozens of times. The first time I saw it was on late night CBS TV. It was like after midnight, and it was one of those talk my parents into letting me, and they would show this, Kolchak movies, or Forbidden Planet. So I caught this. So this, to me, I associate this with like Tron and with like Yellow Submarine as a late night movie. It has a late night feel to it. It's very dreamlike. You know, it was late for me, so I was tired watching it. And it makes, especially like, you know, 10 years old, 9 years old, watching it for the first time, it doesn't make a lot of sense. There's a lot of non sequitur scenes, but at the same time, I think being a kid and the main character being a kid, really, it has a logic to it that's very kid-like. It resonated with me completely. You know,
it's total dream logic.
Yeah.
I was talking to Chris before we got on, and I said, this movie plays by nobody's rules but its own, and its own internal logic, of which it's very loose. And that's fine, because it's not supposed to hold your hand. It's not supposed to be some sort of linear narrative. It is a movie that is a dream, and it is a dream about, it's a meditation on death. And what if... what if when you die, it's not what you think it is?
Well, the story now, the legend now, and like when you see Coscarelli interviews and stuff, because I was doing a lot of, not really research on this movie. What I was really trying to do is track down this interview he gave to Fangoria magazine. And I used to have the actual issue. I think it was Fangoria number 2. So it was an early issue of, it had the Deadly Spawn on the cover. I remember that. And it was a nice like 2 or 3 page interview with Coscarelli, and he was talking mostly about Phantasm, but he was talking about his earlier films too a little bit. And now the sort of what he says is, oh, this is a movie about the rituals that surround death, you know, on the sub level of it. But in this interview, he was a lot more specific. He was talking about the first two movies he did, and the movie he had done just before that had the same kid who played Mike in it. And it was about a group of skateboarding teenagers, you know, and it was a teen, you know, young, like 11-year-old kid, California teen drama, and that he was really interested in making movies from kids' point of view that weren't condescending, you know, that were the way, you know, that showed the sophistication that kids have, and that he wanted to bring that into this movie, especially because he had Mike in it. But he was basically saying, and it's sort of given away at the end of the movie in a way, if you could call it given away. But he was saying basically the movie was about a kid. It was like the dream of a kid who had lost his brother and was trying to, you know, piece it together. And so the whole movie, you know, at the very beginning, they have all those scenes of him chasing Jody, you know, down the street. You know, he'll drive off with his car and he'll chase him on his bike. And he's always just sort of chasing after him. And I always remembered that. And I was trying to find that interview so I could confirm it, that was what I really read back, you know, way back in middle school. Then I couldn't find it. I just don't have the issue. And then I was looking on eBay for it. And of course it's ridiculously expensive. So if there's anybody out there with that issue, I would appreciate it if you like looked it up and confirmed that for me. That would be really, really awesome. Or snapped a picture of the page. I want proof. But it works. It works under that. It works under all those interpretations, and it can work under any number of, it can work under the science fiction movie interpretation of it, you know. And what I'm assuming is, I've seen part two and part three and part four, but I'm thinking it's probably going to go more along the science fiction line while keeping it weird. Mm-hmm. But it just had every – I did not know. All I knew is all my friends had told me when they saw it on HBO about the ball, and that's what I wanted to see. And I had no idea that there was going to be any kind of science fiction-y aspect of it. So that just made my brain explode.
Yeah, and that, what's funny is that that's the – besides the tall man and the silver sphere are the two kind of iconic images, to use an overwrought phrase, from the Phantasm series, you know. And really, the spheres are not in this movie hardly at all.
Mm-hmm.
They have one really big scene, and then they show up again.
Make a big impression, though.
Oh yeah, they make a huge impression. But yes. Really, it's the kind of you know, heart and soul of the fear in this film is the tall man.
Yeah.
And you know, just every time that that Angus Scrimm is on screen as the tall man, he is arresting.
And, even in broad daylight, that slow motion, broad daylight,
freaked
me out as a kid.
And or the bit where he grabs the when Mike is watching him and he grabs the casket with two hands and throws it into the back of the hearse is just, you know, that's like, okay, that's weird. But what's funny is on the copy I watched for this, at the very beginning, it had a little introduction by Angus Scrimm where he talked about that he had worked with Coscarelli, and Coscarelli said, I want you to play an alien. And he had assumed that he meant a legal alien and coming to the United States and learning to live the American dream. And he says, no, I played an alien from another dimension. and he said that and what's funny is that he says that he really enjoyed playing this role, even if he didn't get much more to say than, boy!
Well, everything he did get to say, he milked every little bit out of it that he possibly could. Yeah, carved a place for himself forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more than say, you know, Christopher Lee or Peter Cushing in the Hammer horror films, Angus Scrimm has sort of cemented his place in the horror genre with the character he portrayed in these films. It's just so arresting every time he is on screen, and it's surprising. He's also like one of those characters like Lee and Cushing, who seemed perpetually old at the time. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm assuming that the introduction that he did for this DVD that we watched was done rather recently,
probably in the 90s. I'm thinking
he doesn't look much older than he did, you know, when this film was filmed in the late 1970s, 78, 79.
He's coming back for Ravager, and he was in John Dies at the end.
So yeah, he's definitely really looking old now.
He's old. I mean,
which is fine, because he's, you know, it's the tall
man.
Old.
He's a tall man, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's not like the tall man is a physically imposing character, but he's not like, for example, something we've talked about here, Kane Hodder as Jason Voorhees.
Yes.
he's not gonna chase you down and rip you apart. He's gonna chase you down, but it's because of how creepy and weird he looks, and the costuming does a lot to that too. They purposely gave him a suit that was too small for him to make him look even taller by his arms sticking out. Yeah. And so, Tall Man is classic. And he's one of those guys that, again, most, to use a term from the comics I've been reading, most Normans and Normas don't know the Tall Man. If you'd say Phantasm, they might know the Silver Sphere. But I think to the horror aficionado, the horror fanboys and fangirls, Tall Man's right up there with the other icons of the 70s and 80s of that new wave of horror that we got as we moved into the Carter and Reagan administrations, you know. The Leatherfaces, the Jason Voorheeses, the Michael Myers, the Freddy Kruegers of this world. Tall Man is right there, I think, for us, he is.
Yeah, but like you said, the normies don't know. And part of it is because it's not an oversaturated series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the first one came out in 79. The next one was, what, 86?
88.
Yeah. And then 94, 98, and there hasn't been one since. I mean, so it's not something that's been beaten over the head in the popular culture.
Well, after one, you sort of had to, probably after two more, you had to search them out after they were video store
fodder.
Whereas and one remember, was a huge hit, you know.
And just two, I remember having a huge ad campaign because I was a kid when 2 came out, and I hadn't seen the first one yet, and I remember saying, wow, this looks really cool, but obviously being too young to see it at 7 or 8 years old, despite, you know, being okay to see Predator and RoboCop, but again, we won't get into that again. I think part of it also is I've seen 1 and 2, I haven't seen beyond that, but I think having Coscarelli be involved with all of them is the other thing that really sets it apart. You know, I mean, obviously, Wes Craven wasn't involved in all the Nightmare films. You know, Sean Cunningham was not involved in all the Friday films, or, you know, John Carpenter with Halloween and so on and so forth.
No, these are his baby.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. So I think you get into a similar kind of situation like we would see with the later franchise of Saw, where having the consistent crew, not necessarily the exact same people in the case of Saw, but having consistency and continuity behind the camera means that the overall story can hang together better. And in a film that's as starting with this film, which operates on so much, like we say, in its dream state logic and has its own rules that it plays by, that is crucial. You know?
Oh, yeah. This series definitely does. And there's probably a lot better continuity in these films than just about any other horror franchise, I think, having watched all 4 of them.
I'm looking forward to that now that you say that, to check that out, because I thought it was going to be the opposite of that. I thought it was going to be free for all.
See, and I think it benefits from this first film having it sort of dreamlike feel and not having a specific point of reference of what's going on. You don't know exactly what's going on in the film. They're just little things seated. The strange, small dwarf characters and the sort of almost Jawa
space type Jawas. Bones. Yeah. Well, yeah, actually, Jawas are space Jawas.
Yeah. Jawas are space
interdimensional Jawas.
Running around, you know, capturing people. You know, this tall man who can get his fingers cut off and bleeds essentially embalming fluid.
Oh,
you
know,
the whole weirdness of it and that you don't know what's going on allows for sequels to set up more and more and, you know, build upon, you know, what we've got from this first movie. So I think that's what makes this movie such an engaging and fun and just gripping, you know, horror film.
Here's the thing, it starts right out with a cheesy sex scene.
Yeah. Nudity in the first 5 minutes.
Nudity right off the bat. And then it just pummels you with awkward dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Awkward dialogue. And, you know, at this point, upon first watching it, I wasn't like the normal viewer because I'd actually read, like, the interview with Coscarelli, and I realized this guy's really intelligent.
Yeah.
You know? And this awkward dialogue, it has something to do with having a limited actor pool to draw from. But I think he was purposely setting a tone of weirdness and unreality. Just a scene where they're just like, yeah, he's dead, you know? can't believe he killed himself. You know, it was just very, it just seemed like really horrible acting. But
and
then
even
he,
there, in that, not to interrupt you, Chris, even right there, that alone starts setting off the spider sense, so to speak, because oh, can't believe he killed himself when we saw him being stabbed and murdered.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's when I was thinking, like, how did that get passed off as a suicide?
Right.
That's but why you don't fuck in a grave yet.
Right.
Well,
right.
I heard that was good luck. But and you're right. I mean, all the weirdness, the stilted sort of delivery, and then you add the music on top of that, the very simple Phantasm Liet motif. And even if you've never seen Phantasm, if you're listening to this show, you know the Phantasm music.
Yeah, it's very very Tubular Bells.
Yeah,
exorcist-y.
But it was clearly, and in fact, the Coscarelli even came out and said it was inspired by the work of Goblin and other, you know. The idea of having a kind of
it's obvious, a
rock soundtrack a little bit to a horror film. You know, it's very much in the Fabio Frizzi and Goblin sort of template, I think, which is, again, to its benefit. That's not a criticism in any way. A film with
it's creepy. It's ends
creepy
up being really
as hell, yeah. And it works similar. You mentioned Tubular Bells again, like in The Exorcist, adding this little bit of this kind of unworldly sort of sound to it makes all the weird stuff that much weirder.
Can we start talking about the weird stuff?
Let's talk about the weird stuff, because what I think is funny is that
actually
this film is fair. The film is progresses along certain lines for the first 30 minutes. Then Mike breaks into the mausoleum. The silver sphere shows up, and all hell breaks loose.
And then it just everything's on the table, and it's just. I mean. Just bringing up the bleeding embalming fluid just reminded me of just how beautiful that scene is, where, you know, he slams a door in front of him and he's sitting there, and then you hear the thump, thump, thump of his fingers, and he looks up and sees his fingers
around
there, and the first thing his first thought is, hack him off, and then his next thought is, I better take one of these for proof. That's when I knew I loved this movie. Because
Mike's awesome.
Mike is a real little kid. Yeah, Mike is like how we would imagine that we would react. Actually, we'd be cowering under our beds, shitting and pissing ourselves. But Mike is the way we would like to. And I mean, that was the way back in those days. Kids were a lot more independent, and it's really funny how they talk about how sophisticated kids are in these days, but. Jody's giving Mike the keys to the car in this. Like, here, take the car home and, you know, do this. Yeah. The kid's no stranger to driving. And I knew a lot of kids back in the 70s, early 80s who were like that. You know, 10, 12-year-old kids, their parents were letting them drive around and stuff. You could get away with it a lot more then, too. But, you know, kids were pretty sophisticated back then. And Mike does not fuck around. When things start getting weird, he starts getting prepared and does not hesitate to use violence.
To
the credit of Jody and
Reg
and Reggie.
Yeah, they don't treat him like
once I love the scene where he's like, okay, and now you've got the finger in the box after he's just told him the whole ridiculous story. Looks in the box and he goes, okay, I believe you. Now let's go kill this guy. Let's go put bullets in this guy.
We gotta talk about what happens to the finger, though.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Turns into a Zanti misfit.
It turns into, like, now watching it, one of the, like, fakest special effects ever.
But it plays so good, because it's just crawling up the back of his head.
But when I saw that the first time, when you see his hair just sort of, like, push up and the legs come up over the back of his head and his eyes are tipped up. It's just one of the great scenes in horror movies of all time.
And I really like the physical acting where he's got it wrapped up in the coat and he's just throwing himself
they
around. They
kind of throw themselves all over the room.
Yeah. And I love that we get those great loving shots of what I dubbed those 70s steps. The steps with the floating steps with the carpet on them. I was like, oh, it's those 70s steps again. But them throwing themselves around like a Three Stooges act. you know, to show this thing writhing, and they're like, oh, it's so,
I think
it's so great, it's so
simple. I think he was paying a little tribute to Raimi in a lot, in parts of this movie. There were little,
there's a bit of Evil Dead.
When did Evil Dead drop, though?
I don't know.
I don't think Evil Dead dropped till after.
I want to say it was 80.
Yeah,
I can't be certain.
There's certain, you know, there's certain point of view shots and stuff in it that's just very, very Sam Raimi. Maybe it was just a style that was coming about in those days, and those two were the early users of it. But you know, there's moments in it that are very Evil Dead, like where it gets especially Evil Dead 2, which was definitely later.
Yeah, but
where it gets zany.
Yeah.
Wikipedia says Evil Dead was released in 1981. So we've got another couple of years till we got to Evil Dead. You know, maybe,
so maybe,
you know,
there was some effect on Evil Dead from Fantastic.
Now, that I wouldn't doubt that. You know, I know Raimi released a film called Into the Woods.
But hardly anybody saw that.
Yeah, so, and that was more of a student film. So I don't think Coscarelli would have known anything about that.
Right.
Yeah, Coscarelli's a California boy, and Raimi's a, what,
Detroit? Yeah, he's Michigan. Yeah,
Michigan,
somewhere.
Yeah.
Coscarelli had already, and he had already made completed two movies by that time. So he was sort of on, not really on his way. I mean,
no, but he wasn't just some kid with a camera anymore.
Right.
Either,
no.
You know?
Yeah.
By the time of Phantasm, you know, he had done Kenny and Company was a couple of years before that, and Kenny and Company was actually a pretty good little movie. If you ever get a chance to see it,
I've only seen scenes from it, but I really want to see it.
I saw Kenny and Company when I was a kid. I saw it on HBO, and it's a good little movie. I mean, it's well made. Obviously, Coscarelli's a pretty, you know, he knows his way around a camera, and I think he wrote Kenny and Company as well. So, you know, Coscarelli was established at this point. I think, Chris, you're on to something, that it may have just been the style of the times, you know, because there's other films, lesser films, and as well, that kind of fit that sort of, just a little oddball kind of approach to some of this stuff, you know. The way I've always loved, the way I've heard Evil Dead described, is that, you know, Ash dies in the first 10 minutes and then spends the rest of the film in hell run by the Three Stooges.
Right.
You know, and we get a little bit of that here, because it's just like, oh, it's like when Jody goes to the mausoleum and he gets jumped by the dwarf, and he's got a dwarf right now. He's trying to, the guy's like flinging around on his back. It's like, oh my God, this is a little ridiculous. And then he manages somehow to shoot the dwarf without shooting himself in the head. That alone.
I always pictured that as him putting the gun right to the dwarf and blasting it away. But then when I saw it this time, no, he's just aiming it over his shoulder from a few feet, like 2 feet away.
Yeah,
that's pretty ballsy. Yeah, but that's that. I mean, he's kind of like, although it's Mike who's the real brains of the thing, I guess Jody is kind of the superhero in it, because it's his big brother that he looks up to. It's really like psychologically really neat little thing, and it's funny because then there's we haven't even really brought up except to say his name, but then there's Reg.
Reggie.
I love Reg.
Oh, you
yeah, but he
Reggie.
Doesn't. He doesn't get to do anything in this film. He's basically, you know, the comic relief slash, you know, wimpy guy.
He's the lesser. He's like the lesser brother. You know, there's the prodigal son, Jody, and it sort of hints that Jody's a rock star, of that, some sort, or has some career, because they're like, oh, you've been on the road, and,
and maybe
well,
it's the Jody killed... the roadie.
It could be too.
Well, like Charlotte, is that like Charlotte the Harlot, Jody the Roadie?
Show me your legs.
But either way, you know, like either way, that would be something that the kid would like idolize him.
Well, Reg and the guy that died at the beginning and Jody all played music together.
Right.
I think that was the idea, you know. So I don't know. I got the feeling
that Reg probably didn't go on tour with him. You know, he was his buddy who was not quite as good as him and not quite as handsome as him. He's balding and he's kind of cheesy. Hey, man, you know.
Oh, get ready for the sequels.
I know. Well, that's what I'm saying. This guy is not. I watched recently the trailer for Ravager again. And spoiler, at the end of the trailer, there's a giant ball in the sky with Reggie standing on the ground. And you can tell it's at a distance, but you can tell he's going, no, why? Because his hands are like going, like doing the no, why, like sort of thing, like where you pull them off your head, you know? Yeah. It, broad miming of, you know, no, why? And I was just like, oh, it's Reggie, you know? But he's not a bad guitar player. They actually, that the song wasn't bad.
It's 70s.
But I love how they just were like, playing, you know, they were like, let's play the song. It's so 70. And it's just like, and you could tell those two, it had this feel of like, during filming of the movie, that he and Reggie like had worked up this song, and they were like, hey, you know, man, that's pretty good.
They did.
Let's put that in the let's make sure we get that in the movie, you know?
Oh, you get
I know,
on.
We'll do a scene where Reggie comes over and they jam together, you know, and we'll put that song in there.
You get a full on Mike Thornberry original in Phantasm IV for the end credits.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I tell you, the way that Reg looks, I know he's playing the guitar, but I would have pegged him as a bassist. Like you said,
yeah.
Not quite as good looking, balding, you know, kind of dorky. Yeah, you, sir, you play the bass. Thank you very much.
Ice cream man all the way, man.
It's like, it's such a is that his whole income? He sells ice cream? What does he do during the winter?
So.
Oh, it's California, though. I guess there is no winter.
I do love that when they throw the dwarf of their friend, he's not going to ooze a lot all over my ice cream, is he?
Yeah.
He's worried about his product. There's a man, you know, who cares about his job. So that's nice to see in a film.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing that the one bit that's always kind of stood out a little bit to me is that, you know, after the beginning where we get the stuff at the funeral and in the funeral parlor and all that.
Fortune teller.
Yeah, Mike goes and sees the fortune teller.
Non sequitur scene.
Yeah, like that's supposed to come back around somehow, other than, you know, the fear is the killer, which made me think, of course, fear is the mind killer, mm-hmm. Frank Herbert. But he has taken the Gam Jabbar. But that. Yeah, Phantasm directed by David Lynch. Noodle on that one for a little while.
Oh,
but,
sweet Jesus.
But yeah,
Dune directed by Bob Coscarelli.
It would have made a lot more fucking sense, I can tell you that. But the so he goes to see the old fortune teller, and it's like the fortune teller and her granddaughter have that little smile at the end of it, and I'm not, what the hell is that? What
I
is
keep
that
noticing.
Fortune
I noticed
teller comes back.
I noticed something new in this too is fortune teller grandma had a little tattooed star right in the middle of like her third eye spot. And fortune teller daughter had one, but like on her cheek. And I'll bet you it moves up as you get older and more fortune tellery until it's right up. You know, she's the. It was just a neat little touch. You know, it just showed like she's lower in rank or in skills or younger or something.
And it was the 70s, man.
Oh, she was a total 70s. She was that total 70s Sandra Locke, sort of like a little homely, but that made her kind of hot.
Yeah.
Sort of look.
Yep.
And
the other thing is like, even just that scene in general, it does kind of make no sense, but it's like, if you're a kid and you're trying to find stuff out, you're going to go everywhere you possibly can.
Oh, no. If you had a place where there was the old lady and the cute girl who read your fortune, they know him by name and not like in a spooky like, how do you know my name? He's obviously been over there a bunch of times to the point of like familiarity, you know. So yeah, it just takes that for granted, then it just drops it forever. I always
It doesn't drop it forever.
Well, is that
in this
the same,
one it does.
Is that the same? Oh yeah, you're right. In this movie it does. I always assumed when you saw the girl walking into the room and then heard the scream, I always thought that was the girl from the fortune teller's place, but then I realized on further viewings that it was not. And that didn't make much sense either, because I thought she was already evil by then. So,
well, let's say maybe that was before the beginning.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, maybe.
You know?
Yeah, it's...
Speaking of before the beginning, what... I like how we just sort of get dangled out teeny tiny little hints about who the tall man is. Teeny tiny little hints. And one of them's the awesome sepia tone picture that comes to life.
Ah.
And it's so creepy because then he looks at the camera. It's like, oh shit.
You're breaking the fourth wall, man.
Well, then there's the fourth dimension.
Then there's a shot of him walking down through the town, and a little bit of the cold from the ice cream truck hits him and kind of annoys him and is anathema to the tall man. So that's how they sort of get the idea to put him on ice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the dwarves on ice.
That's a staple that definitely comes back into play. The cold.
Mm-hmm. Tall men no like cold.
Yeah. Yep.
I do like some of the real kind of obvious indie stuff when Jody's getting his on in the graveyard, the obvious use of a body double for the chick.
Oh yeah.
Which I'm not complaining, mind you, but it's just the way it's shot. It's like, okay, we've got this girl that she'll show her face, but she won't show her chest. We need a girl that'll show her chest, but we can't show her face. How do we shoot this?
Well, it's also that scene's also brilliant because the two sex scenes in it are very much make sense if they're happening in a kid's dream, because they're very, you know, like the two adult characters who are getting it on with the woman. I'm assuming, especially Jody, they've had sex before, so it wouldn't be just sort of like, oh, it's very Family Guy, like, all right. Yeah, but, you know, it's just sort of like, and they're like, wow, you know, when they see the boobs. That's not, sometimes that's how it goes.
You're not supposed to do that?
Yeah, the positioning, they're either very, very limber, or they're not doing it right, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I've had sex at least twice.
Yeah, and three times in my case. I hear you, brother. But I love Mike's response when Jody's getting on. He's like, yeah, because we'd all be like that. It's like, yeah, my older brother's getting some. Awesome!
Yes.
You had sisters. So that's not quite the same. But, you know, it's almost you expect to hear, like, from the audience, from the bushes, rock, rock on, Jody!
but the scene where he goes running, screaming by is also just classic.
And he's like, you stay here!
But that was great. It was just, you know, Cascarelli's like, okay, you're going to run by, scream like a girl. And he was at that awkward age, too. He was at that Fry's with that age.
Puberty level, yeah.
He
was much like the kid from Escape from Witch Mountain, but not as creepy looking.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, there's a couple of shots here where Mike gets lit the right way, and he looks a little bit like a young Jodie Foster, which makes it even the weirder.
Oh, that's
weird.
Funny. That's yeah.
Because if it's, oh, I'm Jodie Foster, how you doing? And, but no, he did. There's some bad stuff going up there at the graveyard.
Oh, what else can we talk about after that? Oh, the white room.
Oh, in the white room, where a lot of bad shit happens.
See, that's where it took I love that even that late in the movie, it's still just taking turns. And the visuals in that room are so far away. They're cold, clean, antiseptically lit with barrels piled up. And you're just like, what now? What?
What? Yeah, what are these barrels, and what are these two, you know, silver poles coming in? They're like tuning fork poles. And they, you know, obviously Reggie goes over there and he's like, I remember this from the tuning fork. I'll touch these and see what happens. And it's just all kinds of freaky, you don't know what's going on, shit going on.
It's gone from this moodily lit, very organic looking movie to all of a sudden it's got a cold science fiction feel to it, and mm-hmm. science fiction things are happening
almost 2001, and it's sort of starkness.
Then it goes into like some of the most crazy weirdness of it, of, you know, Mike suspended watching, you know, the Jawas walking into the distance over, you know, matte painting world, optical printing world, and then all of a sudden that scene makes everything make sense. Like when it goes off the rails some more, that's when, at least try to make sense, that's when Mike figures out, oh, they're squashing down people because of the gravity, and blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, oh, everything sort of has an explanation now, you
yeah,
know,
sort
in
of,
a way.
Sort
and
of.
Then it starts chipping away at that, too.
Yeah, and even, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's just enough explanation to kind of build a little bit on it, but
it's
we
like
don't
a
really
dream.
Get more explanation. Yeah,
exactly. It's like the dream is trying to keep you involved by going like, oh no, this is what's going on. Yeah, and then it's like, okay, now we can fuck with you more. You know, you're still paying attention. Oh yeah, okay, maybe it isn't a dream. Okay, you know.
And
now
and
this happens.
Speaking of dreams, the nightmares that both Mike and Jody have. I mean, you look at those little sequences where Mike falls asleep and he's in his bed is in the graveyard and the dwarves come up and grab him, and then the one that Jody has a similar sort of when he dozes off at the house and dreams he's in the white room in the mausoleum. It's like, I'm willing to bet Wes Craven probably saw this film before he did Nightmare on Elm Street. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I mean, understanding that the idea of using nightmare imagery like that is not new or unique to Phantasm, but the very specific way, the unworldly way with the static camera that those are shot really makes me think of the original Nightmare. And again, it's clear to see how all these directors in this time in the late 70s were building on each other, and why this led films like this inspired what became the kind of the really high levels of horror that we got in the 80s was from creative films like this that set the foundation for that in the years prior.
The reaching through the walls of the white room dream reminded me of the reaching through the walls of the white room dream from Day of the Dead.
Yes.
Where she's having the dream and the zombie arms come through the wall and grab her. It's almost set up exactly the same. You know, I mean, you have no choice. It's a white wall person against it. And I'm not sure. I'm sure Day of the Dead came out after this.
Day of the Dead was in the 80s.
Yeah.
83 or something.
Yeah, something like that. And
Oh, no. I mean, this is Hero, you made a really good point about this, that this is not the film that the Normans and Normas of the world know much about. But it's clear why, and to be frank, I hadn't watched this film maybe 15 years, 20 years, and you don't think about Phantasm necessarily like that. You know, you think about, oh, Phantasm, yeah, they made a couple of those, you know, it's like, yeah, it was good, yeah, you know, it's a silver sphere, tall man, okay. But you forget about, I think, some of the, you know, these things that were done in this film that would be influential down the line and stand out watching it and make the film a superlative effort among some of its contemporaries.
Well, there was
I'm glad that we watched it for this, because it made me sit down and rewatch it, like I said, for the first time in a long time, and remember just how good a film it is. And despite its Poverty Row origins being made for $300,000,
right.
Even $1979 dollars, that's not a lot of money. You know, and to be an effective, creepy film that uses some of the negatives, it does the Paul Heyman. It hides the negative, accentuate the positive. It's like, story's a little wonky, let's run with
let's
that.
Let's it out even more.
Let's make it so wonktacular that they won't know what which way is up. It's like, nightmare imagery, let's go as hard as that as we can, really push that envelope, and then we'll make it all a nightmare.
Yeah.
So it plays, like I said, it plays within its own rules, and it sticks to its rules, and then it fucks with you anyway.
Well, I always picture I feel bad for Coscarelli. I think he should have been to the level of like maybe John Carpenter. He reminds me a lot of John Carpenter.
Oh, he's definitely an auteur.
No matter when you see one of his movies, no matter how they always sort of tend towards the goofy seeming, and then when you're watching him, you realize there's some real intelligence behind this and some subtlety towards it. And he definitely took a cue from the Sam Raimi thing, where he took like Beastmaster and then translated it into a TV series and stuff.
Yep.
But it's always been on a lower, you know, just a lower tier than his peers.
Yeah.
Which I think he's just starting to get, you know, recognition within his peer group. Like, you know, when he comes out with something new, I think Bubba Hotep bought him a lot of,
yeah.
took a lot of more straight-laced film goers appreciated that movie, you know. It was almost it had such strong acting in it that they couldn't
But even Bubba Hotep, demonstrative of Poverty Row filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
They Coscarelli desperately wanted to get scenes from Elvis's films that the king would see. And they said the amount to license even a clip of one of Elvis's films was more than our entire budget.
Wow.
Which is why they used the commercial, which was public domain, of a commercial of the king's for the king's movies instead of a clip from the movie itself in that film.
Oh, so even then, even with
it works. And even then, you again hide the negative, accentuate the positive. It's the exact same thing that I said about John Carpenter when we started talking about him. So I think the comparison is apt. You know, they both kind of approach their admittedly genre content from the same sort of, it's a genre movie, but why would we do this? Let's examine it, you know? It's not just, okay, shoot it, you know, the Roger Corman light and get away method of directing, you know? So there's some thought here.
Yes.
And I agree about Beastmaster. Beastmaster is a film that, I mean, you ask most people, oh yeah, it's the one with the two ferrets.
Yes.
Most people remember, or that the one where they killed that cat. And oh my God, that was stupid. But that's, again, neither here nor there, nor do I think that was his decision to paint that poor cat with paint and have it die. But Beastmaster is a good little movie. It's just a kind of schlocky sword and sorcery movie, but it's a lot of fun and it has creative stuff. Those two ferrets have become like a genre trope.
Right.
The thieving ferrets. And it's just a little thing that's done here as something to be fun and memorable.
It was a movie that was kind of mocked when it came out. It got bad reviews. It was kind of mocked when it came out because it was at the tail end of the sword and sorcery craze.
It was a sword against sorcery.
Definitely low budget. And it had lines like, I am Dar and I'm seeking the Temple of Ar and stuff like that.
But it also had John Amos, so.
But then he was able to take
it. Tanya Roberts.
And the legs it got on HBO, I'm sure.
Oh,
and sell it
plays
into a successful TV show.
HBO and TBS. TBS played that thing so much that for a while people were calling TBS the Beastmaster station.
And every time it plays, Coscarelli gets a check. So, I mean, he's been smart with his properties.
And Sean, to go with what you said, for a while HBO joke was, "Hey, Beastmaster's on." Oh, did you? I'm sorry, I couldn't
Jesus
hear you.
Jesus Christ! Everybody's talking over my jokes.
I'm sorry, Chris. Fix this in post, please.
Yeah, better fix it in post. I gotta bring up another topic. How awesome is the Hemi Cuda?
Oh, yes. It's friggin' badass, and I love that. I love that. Apparently, Coscarelli realized that because he knew a guy that had one when he was in high school, and realized, hey, if I write this into the movie, I can get I can get one of these cars for myself.
Now, from what I gather, and this is, you know, looking ahead a bit, the Hemi Cuda stays kind of throughout the movie, but I thought it changes. I thought in different iterations it was a different.
It's not the same exact car. At one point it is a convertible, but Reg drops a line about having to fix it. So there's a Hemi Cuda in everyone.
All right, I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, you should, because
were characters in the 70s.
And it's a pretty good car chase, as darkly lit as it is in this movie. And honestly, in the rest of them, like, the car stuff, the physical stunts are really good for low-budget movies. There's a lot of really good car stunts coming up.
Oh, yeah. Again, even with the, you know, just it's pretty, like you say, it's pretty low-key, but it's well done with them shooting, with Jody shooting at the hearse as it's chasing them. And again, considering how you know they had to do it, and on the budget they had, you know, that's pretty impressive in and of itself from a technical standpoint.
Good stuff. It is good stuff.
I love that the hearse does the classic hit, just the random pole sticking up.
And then just, you know, explodes
in a ball of.
Yeah, well, you know that the lesson here is never store your combustibles with your old people. I think that's a positive takeaway from watching the film and this episode for all the listeners.
I've got to call my grandmother after I get off this call. See if she's making sure to keep her barrels of flammable liquids out of the house.
Just make sure it keeps the barrels of decomposing midgets.
Yeah. You know what else I love in this? We only see it for just a quick cut. Is the Sphero Vision?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
With the all red out. You know.
Yes. Which will make
now. Am I
great
correct in remembering
predator.
That? Yeah. Am I correct in remembering that we would get more of that Sphero Vision in the sequels?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, though I think they'll kind of Walleye Vision as well. It'll get that sort of weird. Like hey, doorbell, there. Yeah. When you're looking out the eyepiece of your hotel room, you'll get that sort of fisheye lens thing. Yeah,
you get a lot more with the spheres, and especially in terms of what exactly they are.
Well, I remember being in a rock concert somewhere, and they were playing Evil Dead 3 or 4 in the background behind the band, like on the monitor.
Only 3 Evil Deads, Chris.
Yeah.
Or not Evil Dead, I'm sorry, Phantasm 3 or 4.
Okay, I was going to say, what the hell have you seen?
Well, there's actually a logic to that Spoonerism or whatever. because I remember seeing it and purposely getting my eye drawn to it, but not wanting to see it because I wanted to watch the whole movie. But thinking to myself, he's taking a cue from Evil Dead 2 and is just going into pure gory action, I couldn't hear what they were saying because they were just playing it on the monitors, but I could tell Reg was getting some catchphrases in there, Bruce Campbell-esque. It looked like they were we're going to make Reg into Bruce Campbell.
they certainly try.
And I'm all for that. I think that's if you're going to do something with Reg, do as much as possible. Especially if you're going to pick your lead badass to be a sort of paunchy, balding guy with a...
Which is mentioned.
Serial killer ponytail.
Who drives an ice cream truck.
Which is a serial killer job, yes.
Exactly.
No, the fact that he is balding and middle-aged is not lost on the characters.
I love that, you see, but that's awesome. I'm hoping it will be anyway.
It leads to some good humor. Ha! He's an ice cream.
Oh, hey!
Oh, boy.
All right.
I get it.
I got that reference. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy.
I get jokes. Well, I can't wait because we're going to cover... And if I could talk everybody else into doing some more Coscarelli movies, I wouldn't mind.
Yes, absolutely.
I wouldn't mind hitting at least Bubba Hotep and maybe even John Dies at the end.
And Beastmaster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would.
Beastmaster
even, I would,
too. Yeah, might as well.
I wouldn't
Not
even
Beastmaster
mind doing
two.
No,
Beastmaster
I wouldn't.
T-O-O.
Beastmaster as well. Yes, I wouldn't mind doing that because that's a fun film, and there are some horror aspects in that. The creepy ceiling crawling witches things, those are cool. So and it's a fun film. I remember watching the hell out of that. So
I have no problem doing Beastmaster as long as we don't do A Tour of the Flying Eagle. So
God, I had that on VHS.
Christ, no. Not unless we can do the MST3K.
Yeah,
that could be a media masochist.
Yeah,
A Tour of the Flying Eagle. Go right ahead with that.
The other thing that we had talked about, the kind of general feel of this time, late 70s, early 80s, the twist ending. Do we want to get into that here? I guess spoilers are on.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what my note is, twist ending in the style of Carrie and Friday the 13th.
Yes. It's in the style of the 70s. Can't end well. Are things going well or relatively well or winding down at a calm note? They can't do that.
And it plays so good because it is, oh, sorry, Mike, your brother is actually dead.
Yeah.
And you know this, but I'm here for you. So let's get out of here and go see America. Just two hard traveling heroes, and we'll go see America. But
where are we going? I guess we'll find out when we get there.
I know. And then where are we going? We're going right through the friggin' window.
It's death. It's the inevitability of death. The tall man is death just chasing him down. And now Mike has accepted it. Come on, let's go, Mike. Get your gear.
And it would have been enough of a twist ending just to have it be, you find out at the end, all the stuff was in his head.
Yeah.
You know,
It still could be.
Wow, that's still, the only way it
could, that could be just the point where he wakes up.
It could be Inception, you know? It could be dream within a dream within a dream.
And please don't have it be Inception.
What's funny about that that scene is when I was a kid, what happens in it is he opens a door and there's a mirror on the door, so you see the tall man standing against the wall in shadow. But the way I saw it when I was a kid, it looked like, and the way the shadow is, it's sort of like hooked up behind the tall man. It looked like the tall man was hanging on a hook behind his door and just comes swinging and is just swinging around there on the hook. And for some reason, that's 10 times more creepy for me. I prefer to remember it like that than that he's actually standing there.
Yeah, it's great, too. I mean, I'm a fan of all those kind of gotcha endings. You know, and we talked about that way back when we did Friday the 13th. But this one is another one that it stands out. And it's like you said, a 70s movie can't end well, you know, has to end on a downbeat note. And the way that, I guess I did earlier, when he roars, boy, oh, man, that is that's classic.
Yeah.
You know, that's, you know, the tall man right there. That's it. You know,
that is. Mm-hmm. And if there's any listeners out there who haven't seen this yet, I'd really like to hear what someone as an adult thinks of this, looking at it with the, because when I watched it, it was closer to that time, so it didn't seem 70s to me. You know, it just seemed like a movie. So I wonder how that translates now. I imagine it translates pretty similar to that effect in the Italian movies, which means pretty damn good.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear what people think if they haven't seen it before. If they go find it and watch it, which they should.
Yeah, I think if you take it in the context of the era that it was filmed, you know, it doesn't feel out of place. I think if you can relieve yourself from the mindset that this isn't supposed to be a modern film, this was set in this time period, and this is the way things happen, you'll enjoy it just as much as we have.
Are they crazy? They're giving that kid the keys to a car?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kids and kids to a car?
That's what they do.
They give him a gun, too.
He can't drive. Yeah, this kid handles a gun better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. All I need to know about guns.
The scene where he thinks out getting out of his room using just the shotgun shell he has is just, you know, some of the dialogue is pretty stiff, but that kid's a good actor because, I mean, not a word is spoken yet. You see his entire thought process from beginning to end, and it's great. And his solution is the perfect solution for a kid. It was every kid that I know wanted to try that, but we're afraid to, which is a good thing.
And even then, he figures out this really creative way to get out of it. And what does he get for his troubles?
You know? Snagged,
The tall man immediately has him. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, son of a bitch.
You couldn't get away with that these days. You couldn't get away with a kid doing that. They'd be like, no way, man. Some kid's going to...
The 70s and 80s were rife with child endangerment films.
Yeah, it was the age of Jodie Foster, man. Yeah, she was playing prostitutes at like 6 years old or whatever.
Mm-hmm, well, and anything, you know, anything that Steven Spielberg put out during this time, Kids in Danger, that's perfectly okay. Yep.
That's one of those things I mention all the time, too. It's like, it's, you know, I like when there's actual kids in peril.
And Spielberg and Stephen King, they both captured that real little kids, you know, not just little little Bobby kids. Yeah. Their little kids had dimension to it. And Phantasm, I think, took it even a step further by making it even grittier, you know.
Yeah.
And maybe it was the I I wonder if this is pre or post. It was just the times, but it's had a very Bad News Bears.
It'll be close
to it. Yeah. Kids who were swearing and driving and shooting, and it weren't no thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the one of the very odd things is that Phantasm is not super readily available on DVD. I'm looking at Amazon right now, and Phantasm, the initial film, is in stock at $45.99.
What?
Now, admittedly, it's a loaded disc, and I would recommend that anyone who wants a copy of the film use the Amazon.com link at 2TrueFreaks.com and buy this $45.99 edition.
Wow.
Now, is it just the DVD? It's not a Blu-ray?
Not even a Blu-ray. And Phantasm 2 has been released on Blu-ray, but Phantasm has not. So I don't know if maybe it's a rights thing or, you know, because Phantasm
isn't a good print.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't know. I mean, this DVD is a special edition. It's got a kind of a boatload of special features on it, which is, you know, obviously it's what if you're going to be paying that much for it.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's what I want. I mean, Scream Factory put out the Phantasm 2 Blu-ray, and Scream Factory, they put out a quality product. They've been doing a lot of these films in the 70s. They just did Phantom of the Paradise a couple of months back on Blu-ray. So I'm really surprised, unless, like I said, it's some rights issue. It's tied up with some distribution, that Scream Factory would do Phantasm 2 on Blu-ray, but not Phantasm. So,
I think it's only for America, because I know the UK got a whole box set inside of a Sentinel Sphere.
Yes,
with all four films on it.
I've seen pictures of that.
Yeah.
So I don't know why in America it hasn't dropped in some better form or fashion. I mean, I think I've got the original DVD that it is pretty loaded. It's got a commentary and deleted scenes and home movies and stuff.
But it was a very popular. I mean, it was much more popular movie than Phantasm 2, I would expect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like I said, I'm suspecting, like Hero says, that it's some kind of a rights issue in this country.
Maybe it's over the disco Phantasm song that you hear in the bar.
So maybe Scream Factory is releasing Phantasm 2 just to say, hey, remember Phantasm? This is the second one. You can buy this disc, right? But you know, that one to check out your used bookstores. You know, keep your eyes peeled on eBay if you really want to get a copy of this. But it's totally worth tracking down. And frankly, I mean, I mean, this is a film. If this was a Blu-ray for $45.99, I might drop the money on it. For a DVD, I'm a little hesitant with the HDTV. But again,
it's on whatchamacallit, Netflix.
Yeah, check it out on Netflix for sure. But yeah, I mean, like I said, if you haven't seen this one. And if, especially I think if
it's
listeners
such a treat.
If you enjoyed what we did with the Italian films, I think this is right in that same kind of mindset. So I think if you enjoyed that kind of some of those films that we did there, I think you'll really appreciate and enjoy this one as well.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah, this is I'm pretty sure you're gonna get the highest recommend from all four of us on this one.
Yeah,
this is this is a run, don't walk. Go watch this one.
Magic. I mean, right down to the tall man is played by a guy named Angus Scrimm.
not his real name. I'm sorry, Chris.
Oh, it's still a great name, and
it's a fantastic.
It's a horror. It's a great horror name, and it has a film reference in it. Scrimm. So it's just like perfect. Should have been Angus Ham.
Ooh. I like ham.
That sounds like a sandwich right there.
That's what I say.
The Angus ham.
Ooh, I'd have it. Yeah, I'd get that at a Subway. Angus ham sandwich.
It's not cow and it's not ham. It's all delicious and it's medium rare.
Did you know that Angus Scrimm is a Grammy winning author?
No.
Yeah. Liner notes, man.
Mm. Liner notes.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
For what? Do you know?
Liner notes for many artists ranging from Frank Sinatra to the Beatles, as well as Arthur Rubinstein and Itzhak Perlman.
Huh.
That's about as far across the board as you can
get. Yeah, I gotta figure out what his Beatles liner notes were.
Well, they'd be written under Rory Guy.
Rory Guy, okay.
That's
he's a Rory guy.
If Joshua Lappin Bertone is listening, he probably knows which album that's on.
Yeah. Yeah, and he is actually 6'4" without the shoes. Jeez.
It's a big dude right there.
So yeah, there's a great role in John Dies in the End, too.
Oh, yeah, he does.
He's a tall priest.
We won't spoil that.
Yes. But okay, we'll see you next time. It'll be Phantasm 2. I saw it a long time ago, but all I remember is there's a morgue and formaldehyde involved.
And hey, the ball flash. Is back.
Oh, the ball is always going to be back.
Newsflash, yeah. there's a morgue in everyone.
Dedicate one to the lady. Now, summertime, sip, bang, need something to keep you cool. I'm out summertime, sip, babe, need something to keep you cool. Better look out now, though, Dave's got something for you. Tell you what it is, I'm your ice cream man, stop me when I'm passing by. Oh my, my, I'm your ice cream man, stop me when I'm passing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on a second, baby. I got to put my banana Dixie cups, all flavors and push-ups too. I'm your ice cream man, baby, stop me when I'm passing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Hold on one more. Well, I'm usually passing by just about 11 o'clock. I never stop, I'm usually passing by just around 11 o'clock. And if you let me cool you one time, you'll be my regular stop. All right, boys. I'm gonna put my banana Dixie cups, old flavors and push up to 100 ice cream, man. Stop me when I'm bouncing by. See, now all my flavors are guaranteed to satisfy. Yes. I'm your ice cream, man. Stop me when I'm bouncing by.
If you shop at Amazon.com, please consider using the link at 2TrueFreaks.com to shop there. If you use this link to go to Amazon and then you shop, Two True Freaks gets a little cut of what you buy, and it doesn't cost you anything extra. So you get to shop as usual and help out the Two True Freaks at the same time.
Visit our website at 2TrueFreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Sock it to me?